was here a couple of weeks ago, we did part one of this, but I want to go back and do just a little bit of a recap just to make sure that we're all on the same page. If you'll remember, a couple of months ago when I did the King of the South, I started with this same scripture. It's in Daniel 11, verse 40, where it says, "At the time of the end, the King of the South will attack him, the King of the North, and the King of the North will come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and many ships, and he will enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through them." So I asked the question a couple of months ago, who is this King of the South? And if you'll remember, we went through and talked about who made up the nations that that are a part of the relations to the ancient Israelites. Those would have been the people of Ishmael and Esau. We talked about where those countries are, what makes them up, the whole thing about who they are and where they are. And then we looked at some of the things that were currently happening in the world scene. You look at various activities that are happening in Egypt, in Iran, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Syria. And all of that will play into whatever or whoever will be the final formation of the King of the South. But the last time I asked the question, as we read this same verse here, the King of the South is going to push against the King of the North. Well, who comprises the King of the North? So if you'll remember from last time, we talked a little bit about who this King of the North has been in history to be able to understand who they will be in the future. To understand who they're going to be in the future, we'll see as we read the prophecies, they are going to take up the characteristics of the nations that came before them. If you don't understand where they came from, you won't understand who they will be. It is very important in this particular prophecy to understand who these people are. So I want to go again through a slide. This was the slide that we ended on 2 weeks ago, and I want to just rehearse this, and I didn't bring my pointer today. Do you have your pointer I can come and steal? If you'll remember, we went through three different chapters that talked about the various aspects of who is going to comprise this final King of the North. So let me just rehearse it here. Get my little pointer. Thank you very much. Remember how it works. So we had three chapters that dealt with this. We had Daniel 2. You remember the image of Nebuchadnezzar, where he had a dream. "I have a dream," Nebuchadnezzar said, and he couldn't get anyone to explain it to him except Daniel. So Daniel came along and said, "You saw this great image." And the image had a head of gold. It had chest and arms of silver. It had a thigh area of brass or bronze, and it had legs of iron and feet of iron and clay. And Daniel explained to Nebuchadnezzar that these would be four world-ruling empires. One would come right after another. And that you, Nebuchadnezzar, are this head of gold. This was chapter 2 of Daniel. Again, you remember in Daniel chapter 3, when the wise men were trying to get rid of Daniel, what did they do? They set up an image of gold for everyone to bow down to. This is part and parcel with what Nebuchadnezzar would have seen in his dream. So we know that the first world empire was Nebuchadnezzar, but whoever the second, third, and fourth empire that were to come was not revealed to Daniel during the time of Nebuchadnezzar. But later on, actually 50 years later in Daniel chapter 7, you see that there was another dream that went through some similar opportunities for Daniel to understand what was going on. And then in Daniel 8, there was even some further clarification. So we know that Babylon was this head of gold. Daniel saw it as a lion. Again, if you look at, I even saw it in the news this week as ISIS is going into these various cities where the ancient Babylonians still had their gates, their paraphernalia, their statues, etc. You can still see, until they get destroyed, the lion statues that represented the king of Babylon. So it was a perfect example, and Daniel would have been very clear when he saw this this first ruling empire and its symbol was a lion. Daniel would have known that that meant Nebuchadnezzar, because that was who pictured himself as the lion. But Daniel also saw that there were other things coming, that there would be other groups that would come, if I can get it going here, and that there would be another empire of a bear with three ribs in its mouth and one of its paws extended. And in Daniel 8, it was seen as a goat that had two horns. One would be higher than the other. And that it was actually told to Daniel, the people that will be taking over after the Chaldean or Babylonian Empire falls would be the Medo-Persian Empire. So they would come from the east and would push west, north, and south and take over. And we saw maps of every area that they took over. But then Daniel was able to see that there would be a third empire that would come after them, and that it would be like a leopard, meaning very fast, and that it would start out with one head, but the one head would become four heads, and that it also was seen as this he-goat or male goat that had one horn, which would break off and become four horns. We saw, again, last time that this represented Alexander the Great, who was the head of the Greek Empire. Actually, the whole reason why Alexander took over in the first place was because the Medo-Persian Empire was pushing against him. They had conquered all the way up to the threshold of Greece, and he was biding his time. But when they finally decided, you know, we need to go a little further and take over Greece as well, that's when Alexander stood up and said, you've gone far enough. I'm stopping this nonsense. And in a matter of a few years, Alexander had raced all the way to the area that we would now know as ancient Babylon and took over and was setting within just a few years, he was sitting in the throne room, as it were, of the Medo-Persian Empire. But during one of his drunken brawls, he dies, and his area is divided between his four generals. And so we now have a king of the north, a king of the south, and then a king of the west, and there are two of them in the western areas. So what we ended up talking about was, out of these four empires, two of them, one of them, the Seleucid Empire, became the king of the north, and the Ptolemaic or Egyptian power became the king of the south. So that kind of gets us back up to where we were. And again, if you haven't seen that and want to go back and see that again, there's the whole sermon on it. If it's not out there yet, it will be soon, and you can go back and see who that is. What I got to was this slide where I was about to ask the question, who was the fourth beast, when I looked down and realized that I was over time, or getting close to it. So I stopped right there. So what I want to do is I want to pick up on this, where we talk about who is the last world-ruling empire that's going to come before the return of Jesus Christ. I want to remind everyone of what it was said in Daniel chapter 10 and verse 14. I won't turn there, I'll just refer to it. Where the angel that came to talk to Daniel said, I want to show you things that are going to happen in the end time as it relates to your people, as it relates to the Jewish nation. So when we read in the Bible about north, south, east, and west, we read about that in relationship to the land of Judah. So you can just look at a map and pinpoint Jerusalem, and that is north, south, east, or west on what's going to be said in a lot of these prophecies to come. So as we go through this now, and I've reviewed a little bit of the three of these, I want to start in Revelation chapter 1 in verse 1. And I want to now talk about who this fourth kingdom is going to be. Revelation chapter 1 in verse 1. We know that God revealed things to Daniel. We know that God revealed things to Isaiah. We know that God revealed things to Jeremiah and many other prophets. Sometimes we don't think of John the Baptist as being a prophet like we would think of Daniel. But a lot of information was given to Daniel for him to see in his days, and a lot of things were given to John the Baptist for him to see in his. I should have drawn this up. There's a chart that I used to use when I gave this sermon 10 or 15 years ago, where I had Daniel is like a triangle, where the big part is to the left and the small end is to the right. Daniel was given a lot of information of what would happen during his time, but as it got further and further out, it got smaller and smaller and smaller. Daniel, all he was told was, well, in the end time, there's going to be a power, and it's going to be like iron and clay. And Daniel's like, well, tell me more. No, that's shut up for the time of the end. He wasn't given that. John, on the other hand, was given it the other way. The triangle starts small. God didn't give him a lot of details of the Babylonian Empire, as an example, because that was already well known. But toward the end, there's a lot of information given on what was going to happen at the very end. So as we go through the prophecies that John talks about in Revelation, we're going to see some increasing detail where all Daniel knew is that there was going to be a fourth beast, and it was going to be a dreadful beast. It was going to be great iron teeth, and it was going to have seven heads and ten horns, and that's about all he knew. So we need to find out who these heads are, who the horns are, who the final kings are, so that we can come back to that original question: who will the final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire be as we get down to the end of the age? So Revelation 1 and verse 1. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants things which must shortly take place. And he sent and he signified it by his angel to his servant John. There's a whole lot of information there. I just want to make sure that we understand that piece by piece. The revelation is from Jesus Christ. He's the one that was going to make sure that we understood it. But God gave it to him. You think about this perfect coupling between God the Father and Jesus Christ, his Son. He and the Father, I can just imagine this, they sat down and said, okay, so we need to make sure that they understand what's going to happen in the end time, so what do we show them? And the Father said, you know what, here's what I think we should do. And he laid it out, and Christ said, yeah, you know, you're right, I'll take care of it. And he comes, and he has this vision to John, and he explains to John so that John can write it down so that all of God's servants, you and me, can understand what's going to happen in the end time. Verse 2, and he bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ to all things that he saw. Verse 3, this is us today. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keeps those things which are written, for the time is near. There is not only, and as we go through this today, we are not only going to cover what is going to happen, but we're going to cover what should we be doing. The very end, right at the very end, we're going to read a pretty serious warning to the church. You need to be watching, because there are going to be things happening that could deceive you. And you need to be, there's no reason for you to be deceived. If you are aware of what's going to happen, then this will make sense, so that when it happens, you're not going to be taken off guard. So we'll read that as we get to it. I'd like to turn now to Revelation chapter 13. And you see this picture of this beast up here. Revelation chapter 13. For those of you that are visual learners, you probably will remember this. This picture came out of a drawing that the church had done many years ago. So you'll remember in Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar saw this final empire as two legs and feet of iron and clay. In Daniel chapter 7, Daniel saw that as a beast, and you'll notice very similarly, the Apostle John saw it as a beast too. We're going to go through and we're going to kind of compare these two to try and find out who this final beast is. So again, we know that we've got Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire. It's important that you remember that the first empire was Babylon. That will come right down to the very last slide. So remember, that first one is Babylon. Second one was the Medo-Persian Empire. Third was the Greek Empire. Who is the fourth empire? I want you to think about the perspective as we go through this of who was writing. This is John, the Apostle John. He's probably writing about 90 A.D., I've had trouble with my voice all week, so I'm going to do my best to go through this. I actually might need a second one of these. We'll see how I do. That or a cough drop. Even if someone had a cough drop they could throw my way, that would help too. But this is the Apostle John, and this is 90 A.D. I want you to think about this from the perspective of John as he's writing this. John's writing something down. I think in my mind that John knew exactly who was being referred to here, but there was a reason for him not saying it out loud. So let's read through Revelation 13, verses 1 through 9. And for those of you that don't want to follow along in the Bible but want to see the picture here, that'd be great too. Thank you very much. All right, so as I suck on this Halls, you're going to hear it clicking in my mouth. I apologize for that, but it will help me get through the sermon. So bear with my folly here. Chapter 13 and verse 1. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. And the beast had seven heads and ten horns. So you can see the picture here. Again, we've got the sea. We've got a beast rising out of it. It's got seven heads on it, and this one head has got ten horns. And on his horns were ten crowns, and on his heads were a blasphemous name. So you can see on each of these, it's a little hard to see, but there's a crown on each of them, and then there's writing on these where there's this writing of blasphemy. Verse 2, now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like the feet of a bear. So you can see its body. If you look at the body is like the body of a leopard. Its feet were like the feet of a bear. You can see these big bear paws here. The mouth was like the mouth of a lion. So you can see this lower part of the jaw was like a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and his great authority. So whoever this final world ruling empire is going to be, it's going to have elements of a lion, a bear, and a leopard. That should obviously sound very familiar. If you think back to what was earlier, we have a lion, a bear, and a leopard. What John was being told is this final world empire is going to have elements of all three before it. It's important for us to understand because it will help identify not only who the final world ruling empire will be, but it will also help identify it in history. Verse 3, and I saw one of its heads as if it had been mortally wounded. So of those seven heads on that beast, one of them is going to almost die. And that deadly wound was healed, and the people will marvel after it and follow after the beast. It'll look like this world ruling empire has come to an end because it will look like it has been fatally wounded. And yet, somehow, the dragon will be able to, as it were, resurrect it back to power again. Verse 4, so they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who will be able to make war with him? Whoever this final world-ruling empire will be, it will be worshipped as if it were a god. That's important to understand as well. Verse 5, this beast was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue 42 months. We're going to find out when those 42 months were. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and all those who dwell in heaven. Whoever this final world ruling empire will be against God, against the truth of God. Verse 7, and it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Whoever this final world ruling empire will be or has been, it will involve persecution against the church. So can we identify a world ruling empire through the years that has been antagonistic or opposing to the church of God? Verse 8, all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone hears him, let him hear. So as we read through this, we know that whoever this fourth beast is going to be, it is obvious that this fourth beast is going to have elements of the three that came before it. It has the mouth of a lion, it has the feet of a bear, it has the body of a leopard. So in essence, and you can see that throughout warfare, when a new power comes up and takes over from an old power, they tend to take over all of the weaponry. They learn all of the things that, all of the practices that were done from before it. So this last world-ruling empire, whoever it is, would encompass and would embellish and would identify with those three world-ruling empires that came before it. Now, I would ask this question again. In 90 AD, why didn't John identify it? When we go back in Daniel chapter 2, the first one was identified as the Babylonian Empire. Daniel chapter 7 and 8, the second and third were identified as Medo-Persia and Greek by name. They even mentioned the first ruler would be Cyrus. Why doesn't the angel give to John who this last world ruling empire is? Why not name it by name? It was already in existence. We'll see that in just a moment. So why wasn't it by name? You remember what it says in here, that the Roman Empire that was in place during the time of John the Baptist was at that time actively persecuting the church. So can you imagine if John's writing this down and he says, and by the way, that fourth empire is the Roman Empire, what that would do against the church. So I think that for anybody in the New Testament, if they were reading John's writing and they were saying, look, we know who the fourth empire is going to be. It's going to be great and dreadful. It's going to have great iron teeth. The Roman Empire already at that time was called the Iron Empire. They're going to be persecuting the church. They're going to try and change times and laws and seasons. We'll talk about that in a minute. They will take over the known world at the time, as well as persecuting the church. Anybody that read that would know. John did not have to identify the fourth world ruling empire. All he had to do was describe its characteristics, and everybody reading that would have known who this was. This was the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire in John's day would have been early in its history. So what we see here is the angel was telling John, you see it in its early stages. I'm going to tell you what it's going to be like throughout the life, the resurrections, the various resurrections of this empire, all the way down to the end. Then at the end of the sermon today, we're going to ask the question, who's the last one? Because Daniel 11:40 says, in the end, the king of the north and the king of the south are going to fight. We've got to go to understand who the last one is. We've got to march through the whole gambit of people that led up to that. So that's what we're going to do today. There are going to be many successive kings that would arise after John was writing in around 90 A.D. So again, we see that this beast now, if you compare Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 8, and Revelation 13, we can see that the lion's mouth, the bear's feet, and the leopard's body all come into play from this final beast. The Roman Empire had all the elements of those world-ruling empires that preceded it. I want to read again in verse 2, and I want you to notice how John worded this. John was trying to say, when this beast came up, what was this beast like? You're going to notice he goes in reverse order all the way back to the beginning. It was like a leopard. That was Greece. It was like a bear. That was the Medo-Persian Empire. And it was like a lion. So John was saying, this empire that is in place now, it was like the one before it, and like the one before it, and like the one before it, and it had all of these same elements. But if you look at the image now in Daniel 2, we're going to talk about this in a while. Why did this image in Daniel 2 have two legs instead of just one? We don't see that anywhere else. We see it divided into two. Is there something that would happen in the Roman Empire to divide it in two? And why at the very end is it clay and iron? And why are there 10 toes? You know, in this image, there could have been 12 toes or no toes. There could have been one leg or three legs. I mean, we've got beasts with 10 horns and all of that. We obviously could. There is a reason why this was put down as it was. And we also noticed that there was a lot of persecution against the saints. And we will see as we go through this that persecution has continued from the first century all the way down to today, and it will continue into the future. When you read about the prophecies of this final world-ruling empire, there will be persecution against the Church of God to the point where some people will stop believing because of the intensity of the persecution that will come at the very end. So let's look at the early phase of the Roman Empire. This is the first phase, and the Roman Empire was actually the ones that caused the Greek Empire to fail. It took a while for them. They finally absorbed the four divisions of Alexander's generals. And what we will see as we go through this is that as they conquered the various generals one by one, they eventually conquered all the way down into Egypt. Ptolemy was the last ruler or age to fall, as it were, the last world empire from the Greek Empire. And the Roman Empire took that over in the 30s B.C. So what we see, again, is that the Roman Empire started in 31, approximately, B.C., and it lasted for several hundred years until A.D. 476. What happened in A.D. 476? We'll get there. It's described, again, as a region of iron. If you read about the Roman Empire, you can actually read that. I Googled it just to see if it came up. Who was the Iron Empire? And it comes up and it says the Roman Empire. They were known for their iron implements. They were known for their strength. They also were known for their cruelty. If you look back at what it said about Nebuchadnezzar and about many of the rulers that came before that, there was a modicum of the way fighting was done. You treated your captives with care. In some cases, you destroyed the leadership, but often indentured or put into servitude the people. You look at what happened to the Jewish people. They were well cared for. in the Babylonian Empire. Well cared for. They were in the days of the Medo-Persian Empire as well. But it says here that when the fourth empire would come along, that they would cause a lot of grief against the church. Stronger than all of the metals that came before it, but of less value, the Caesars or the empires of the Roman Empire would crush their enemies. They were a very devastating force. But we also know that in around 330 AD, the Roman Empire ended up being split into two. I want to read a little bit about this today. There were then and there are now today two legs of the Roman Empire. I want to read about this. This is again from history. This is an article on Constantine. It said, Constantine enacted a change in 330 CE that helped accelerate the fall of the Roman Empire. In 31 BC, Rome was a united force. But as Rome started to grow and it started to have factions, it was decided in 330 AD that Constantine would split the empire into two parts. He had a western capital that was in Rome, and he had an eastern capital that was in Constantinople. So if you look at this map again, you see Rome here. This is one of the capital, and all of this area was controlled by Rome. That's going to be important as we look at this in the future. But then he set another capital up, called it after himself, Constantine. He called this Constantinople. And from here, he ruled the western half of the Roman Empire. So we see from 330 on, there were two legs or two divisions of the Roman Empire. And they were very different. The Western Empire spoke Latin. The Eastern Empire spoke Greek. The Western Empire had the Pope in Rome. The Eastern Empire had the leader of the Eastern Orthodox Church, who had his offices in Constantinople. And so after 330, we see that there was a segregation that happened in the Roman Empire. As we look down in not only in history but into the future, there have been some even some speculation about how this might play out in the very end. Because there were a lot of nations that became affected by the western leg or the right leg, or I guess this would be the left leg if it's looking at you. A lot of these nations up here that form a part of Europe today have their influence more with the Greek Orthodox. And many of the other nations that are on the western side have most of their influence through the Church at Rome. So how will this play out at the end? What we see is that there were multiple emergences of the Roman Empire over the years. So let's talk about who they are for a moment. I want to go back and I want to read the first part of Revelation chapter 13. I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, and it had seven heads and ten horns. So we want to identify who the seven heads are, and then after the seven heads are done, then we want to identify who the ten horns are. And also on those ten horns were ten crowns, and on those heads a blasphemous name. Verse 3, I saw one of the heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and the deadly wound was healed, and all of the world marveled after the beast. So if we look at the various heads, we can actually see who they are because they've been identified all of the way down. You can actually see them as you look through here. We've got the first head was the Babylonian Empire. The second head was the Medo-Persian Empire. The third, fourth, fifth, and sixth heads come from the Greek Empire because after just a few years of Alexander's reign, he died, and for the entire rest of the Greek Empire, it had four different heads. And then the seventh head would have been this great dreadful beast that we now know as the Roman Empire. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. The seven heads that we see are Babylon, Medo-Persia, the four from Greece, and then the start of the Roman Empire. It's important as we read through this. I want you to notice again in verse 3, it says that one of those deadly wounds was healed. We're going to look at that in just a moment. Something happened when Babylon came along. It got lax and it fell to the Medes and the Persians. Then when the Medes and the Persians got lax, it fell to the Greeks. Then when the Greeks got lax, it fell to the Romans. But in 476 AD, the Roman Empire fell, and it looked like it had died. Verse 3 here in Revelation 13 says that one of the heads will be wounded almost to death, but that it won't actually die. If you look back in history, history will even tell you that in 476, it looked like the Roman Empire had died. So let's go through that and look at this. Then we see after the seventh head, we see the start of the Roman Empire died around 476. And then after that, there was another resurrection that occurred. And we're going to see that then the ten horns start. So you've got the seven heads that took us all the way through the start of the Roman Empire. But then after the Roman Empire collapsed in 476, there were ten additional resurrections of the Roman Empire. We have the Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths. These were Germanic tribes. These were barbarians. You know what a barbarian is, right? You think of a barbarian as somebody that doesn't brush their teeth or comb their hair, and that's not what a barbarian is. Barbarians were people that came from a system that didn't have a strong government structure. When you look at Rome, Rome was led by emperors. They were led by Caesars. They were led by the Catholic Church. They had a structure to them. Where these Germanic tribes were, they were hungry. I mean, all of the wealth was in Rome, and they're on the other side of the river, and they're starving. So as Rome is opulently living its... if you ever see movies of what the Roman Empire was like just before it was ready to fall, they were in the lap of luxury. They had bathhouses and spas. Marlis and I have gone to some of those where they... the bathhouses where they had all of these, the public areas where you could go and do games and sports and all of this, and it was this life of opulence. They had spas where you could go soak in salt water and salt baths and all of these kind of things from natural springs, natural heated springs. But right on the other side of the river, there were people that were starving in what we would now know today as either Prussia or Germany. So as the Roman Empire started to get lax, there started to be these waves or hordes of barbarians, as the Romans would have seen them, that came over the river, and they started to take over. The first tribe were the Vandals. They actually sacked Rome in 445 AD, and the Roman system, as we know it, started to collapse. There were three different successive rulers that came out of this. The Vandals started, and you can see they were from 429 to 533. Then we see that the Heruli came next from 476 to 493, and then the Ostrogoths from 493 to 554. Three different groups of Germans now took over. Now what I want to do is I want to make some sense out of this so that we can understand this. To understand who the last group, and I'm going to keep coming back to this, to understand who the last group is going to be, you have to understand where they came from. So you've got Babylonians. They had already acquired the Assyrian Empire. You've got the Medes and the Persians. You've got the Greeks. You've got the Romans. Now you've got the Germans. These are people that are making up these world-ruling empires. When we get down to the very last, they're going to have elements of all of these. Some people look at, well, if it's going to be the Roman Empire, it can't be the Germans. Yes, it can be, because the Germans took over the Roman Empire. After they fell in 476, it was the Germans that took over and they ruled. All right, as we go through this, you're going to see even more nations that get represented by who this is. So the Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths, the Germanic tribes, now lead the world. And it looks like the Roman Empire is dead. But is it really? Somebody else is going to come up and is going to start taking control of the Roman Empire. Somebody, so the good offices of somebody, has got to pull the Roman Empire back together. Because right now it's being ruled by barbarians. There's no structure. There's no Caesar. There's no emperor. There's no religious leader. It's just a bunch of barbarians, a bunch of Germans that have come over. If you know anything about the Germans, we were talking about that the other day, they are very, very good at what they do. They're strong. Militarily, they're strong. They're organized in a lot of ways. They're detail-oriented. And they were doing a lot of great things, but it wasn't the Roman Empire as the Romans saw it. So there was something that needed to happen. Who would control the Roman Empire. We know that there are to be 10 horns, and 3 of them represented the Germans as they came over. Something was going to happen right here before the next 7 come. Let's go read about that. Revelation chapter 13 and verse 2. We keep reading this, but I want to read it again. This beast that was going to come was like a leopard. Feet were like the feet of a bear, and the mouth was like the mouth of a lion. But notice what it says. It says, the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and his authority. Who is the dragon? I won't turn there, but I'll tell you in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 9, it says that Satan would cast out their serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan. So this final empire is going to have influence from Satan the devil. When it talks about it being a beast, it doesn't talk about it being a lion or a leopard or a bear. It talks about it being a beast. It talks about crushing. It talks about it being a horrible fighting power. This fighting power is going to have its power, its throne, and its authority by Satan the devil. So this last ruled empire is going to be ruled by Satan. Let's go back in Daniel chapter 7 and let's pick the story up back there, because there's more details that are given in Daniel 7. Daniel 7 and verse 7. And after this I saw in the night visions, behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceeding strong, with huge iron teeth. And it devoured, it broke in pieces, and it trampled the residue with its feet. And it was different from all of the beasts before it, and it had 10 horns, or 10 successions. So what we're going to see as we go through this, that this last beast that was going to come along here, this fourth beast, was going to have 10 successions. But then when you notice in verse 8, it says, and I was considering these 10 horns, and there was another little horn that came up among them, before whom 3 of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. So if you again look at this picture, it says that there were 10 altogether, but after the third one, something arose to help conquer these 3 and then rule over the last 7. Something had to come and take over those Germanic tribes that were ruling this, what had become to be known as the Roman Empire, but yet it wasn't the Roman Empire like they wanted it to be. Somebody had to come, some good office had to come and try and take up the mantle to be able to pull this back the way it was. Verse 8, a little horn would arise. It would pluck the first 3 up by the roots, and there in this horn were the eyes like a man, but a mouth speaking great pompous words. So whoever this man was that would come up, this little horn, it would conquer the first 3, and we know the first 3 were the Germanic tribes, and that it would rule over the last 7. Let's drop down to verse 19 and get a few more details. Daniel is receiving all of this, and in verse 19 it says, then I wished to know more about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with teeth of iron, nails of bronze, and it devoured and broke in pieces and trampled the residue with its feet. And if you want to continue the thought, I wished to know about the 10 horns that were on his head. So again, looking up here, Daniel was seeing 10 heads. He wanted to know about all of this that was coming down here. The 10 horns that were on its head, and of that other horn which came up, before which 3 fell, namely the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. And I was watching, verse 21, and that same horn, that little horn, came up, and it made war against the saints and prevailed against him. So you're going to see this again. After the Germanic tribes get defeated by whoever this little horn is, this little horn is not only going to rule over the last 7, but he's also going to start persecuting the true church of God. We're going to see that in history. We'll see that in just a moment. Verse 22, until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints should possess the kingdom. So we know that whatever is going to happen at the very end, it's also going to involve persecution against the church of God, or against the people of God. Verse 23, thus he said, the fourth beast, this is the angel now talking to Daniel, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on earth, which will be different from all other kingdoms, and it will devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. The ten horns are ten kings that will arise out of this kingdom. So Daniel is being told now, those horns that he saw, and this is the beast that Daniel saw that had ten horns on its head, those ten horns are going to be ten successive world-ruling empires that would come up out of this final break. Verse 24, the ten horns are ten kings which will arise from this kingdom, but another will arise after them and be different from the first and will subdue three kings. So we see that there are ten world-ruling empires out of the Roman Empire, but something's going to come up in the middle of it that's going to help defeat the Germanic tribes and then take over and rule the West, the rest of them. Verse 25, this little horn will speak pompous words against the Most High. It will persecute the saints of the Most High. So again, we see that. And it will even intend to change times and laws. And the saints will be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. Biblical research would tell you that a time is 1 year, times is 2 years, and a half a time is a half a year, 3.5 years. If a year, again in biblical equations, is 360 days, 360 times 3.5 years is 1,260 years. We're going to see when that started and when that stopped. There was a period of persecution against the church that lasted for 1,260 years. We'll talk about that in just a minute. So this little horn arises. It's going to lead the last seven divisions of the Roman Empire for 1,260 years and then seem to just die out again. We'll watch. We'll see that as we go through. Verse 25, he will speak pompous words. He will try and change times and seasons. But something is going to happen that's going to be able to get rid of these three Germanic tribes. So let's look at that now. The little horn started in A.D. 544. Justinian recognized that he needed some help to be able to try and conquer the Germanic tribes. It's very hard to get rid of them. They were a very strong force. They were good fighters, but they weren't as organized as what Justinian felt he could be. But he recognized, I will never be able to pull all of the kingdom of the old Roman Empire together to defeat the Germans unless I have help. So in 544, Justinian recognized the supremacy of the papacy and bowed to the papacy, and the Pope crowned him as the first resurrection of now the Holy Roman Empire. So before this, we had the Roman Empire. I want to go back and show this because sometimes people get a little messed up on this. If you go back and you look, the seventh head of the Roman Empire started in 31 BC and it lasted until 476 when the Germans destroyed it. There was this head back here that was the Roman Empire. But after the Germans take over, Justinian recognizes, I need help to pull this together. So the papacy, then, this little horn comes up and starts to rule. And all of the leaders from that time forward bow to the authority of the papacy. And it no longer becomes the Roman Empire. It is now the Holy Roman Empire. It was called that. My wife and I have visited many of these. We've gone overseas. We spent some time in Vienna, where the Habsburg dynasty were. So we have, not only do we have Germans that ruled, we have Austrians. Napoleon was French. We had people from Babylon, from Medo-Persia, from Greece. All of these nations make up and constitute what will become a part of the final world-ruling empire. So you look at them, some people would look at this and think, well, if it's going to be the Roman Empire that comes up at the end, then it's got to be someone in the city of Rome. No, it doesn't. It has to be someone that comes from the history of the Roman Empire. And in this case, we have Justinian, we have Charlemagne, we have Otto the Great, we have Charles the Great, we have Napoleon. These come from different areas of Europe. The Roman Empire becomes the European Empire. And it was called, during this time, the Holy Roman Empire. Justinian recognized the supremacy of the papacy in 554, and it continued on through the next five leaders. Every one of them either was crowned by the Pope or the Pope went to crown them, and they grabbed it out of the Pope's hand and crowned themselves. I mean, that, I think there was probably more than one event where it was a tussle as to who was going to be in charge. Was it going to be the Pope, or was it going to be the leader of the Roman Empire? But we see that these men, starting with Justinian, wanted to have the supremacy of the papacy to help pull together all of the countries. The countries that were involved in the Roman Empire, whether it was from the Western Empire or the Eastern Empire, were Catholic. And the Catholic Church was very strong. So as they're trying to unite, the power of the papacy could unite the Roman Empire together in a way that could not have been done to help defeat the Germans. So Justinian, wanting to defeat the Germans, bows to the Pope. The Pope says, I will give you my pledge that the Church will be in back of your army. And it helped pull together. Now we've got aspects from the French, aspects from even areas within Germany and Austria that were Catholic instead of barbarian, and eventually these three leaders of the Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths eventually were defeated. Verse 25, again, this little horn will speak pompous words against the Most High, will persecute the saints of the Most High, and will intend to change times and laws. If you look back in history, you know that in the Council of Nicaea, even during the time of Constantine, they were the ones that made the change from Saturday to Sunday. They were the ones that made the change from the holy days of God to the holidays. They stopped keeping, in the Quartodeciman controversy, if you remember reading about that, they stopped keeping Passover and started to keep Easter. They were changing times and seasons of God's law, and they were persecuting the saints of God. At the time when Christianity, and I would put that in quotes, became the official religion, the people of God that were still keeping the Sabbath and the holy days became an object of intense persecution. And the church, in essence, had to go into the wilderness. It had to flee into the wilderness. If you go back and you look at what happened to the church, it ended up in the mountains in France. It ended up just trying to survive any way that it could. And every time that the true Church of God was found out, there was persecution against it. And many true people of God, you can go through and read even in Fox's Book of Martyrs about Sabbatarians that were killed. They eventually ended up in England. They had persecution from the Catholic Church, which became the Anglican Church, and they had to flee to the United States. Most people don't realize this, but and at the beginning when the pilgrims came over to the United States, the vast majority of the people that lived in the early United States were Sabbatarians. Eventually, that became a problem. But when Rhode Island was first started, Rhode Island was started as a Sabbatarian colony where people could come here and have religious freedom from the Catholic and Anglican Church that were causing them so many problems. So they were trying to change the times and the laws. They also were persecuting the church. Sabbath to Sunday, Passover to Easter, and this blasphemy lasted against God's people for 1,260 years. I've got a chart that I'll pull up a little later that shows that. So this went on until Napoleon, who was the last one that we see that was actually crowned by the Pope. It lasted from 544 to 1814. If you subtract 1814 from 544, you end up with 1,260 years. Just like God said. Okay? So Napoleon now was the last leader. So we see five of them have came. So what happens after that? After 1814, the papacy was still there, but it had much less power. In fact, by the time Napoleon's reign ended, the Pope was actually in exile. A lot of people don't realize that. He fled to France to try and get away from the armies that were there that were trying to do harm against the papacy. So he was in exile. So after Napoleon ends, the Pope flees to France. But we know that there have to be two more resurrections that occur. So how and when did this happen? We go further a little bit more in time, and you see I've got a gap here. There was this little bit of gap. Napoleon stopped in 1814. But in 1879, something happened. I want to read this. This is, again, from the history books. It talks about a man named Garibaldi. Most people never even heard of that name. It says, the fate of his homeland, he was an Italian, however, continued to bother Garibaldi. The election of Pope Pius IX in 1846 caused a sensation among Italian patriots, both at home and in exile. Pius's initial reforms seemed to identify him as the liberal pope that was prophesied by many of the prophets in the Catholic Church, who went on to lead the reunification of Italy. So this new pope comes along, they have great hope in him. Garibaldi, who is a leader in the Roman Empire, decides maybe this is the guy that's going to bring another resurrection of the Roman Empire. If you read what it says, if you look in West's book of history on the Roman Empire, it says it appeared in 1814, just 1260 years after the deadly wound was healed, the Roman Empire seemed to dissolve. So closed a government that dated from the time of Augustus Caesar. So after 1814, again, it seemed to die. And yet now here's Garibaldi in 1846 who sees this new pope and thinks maybe there's hope for the Roman Empire yet once again. He writes a letter to the pope and he states this. I'm quoting from the letter. If these hands, meaning Garibaldi's, used to fighting would be acceptable to His Holiness, we most thankfully dedicate them to the service of Him who deserves so well of the Church and of the Fatherland. Joyful indeed shall we and our companions, in whose name we speak, if we be allowed to shed our blood in defense of His Holiness, Pope Pius IX, and his work of redemption. So there is another resurrection of this empire, the sixth of the seven heads, that starts during the era of Garibaldi. While not officially crowned by the Pope, Garibaldi led a restoration of the Holy Roman Empire. It was called the Holy Roman Empire, even though he wasn't crowned by the Pope, by agreeing to serve the papacy. Italy during this period of time was divided into papal states, but the Pope was the one that had great influence on it. Many people don't realize this, for those of you who have read any books at all during this period of time. While Mussolini and Hitler were not officially crowned by the Pope, they both were subservient to the Pope. Hitler himself felt that he was starting the Third Reich, or the resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. He called it that. There are books out there that talk about the relationship between the Pope and Mussolini and the Pope and Hitler. They were, in fact, one of the resurrections of this Holy Roman Empire. So you see, Italy and Germany from 1879 to 1945 were a resurrection of this. But there still is one yet to come. Hasn't happened yet. And that's the one that we want to eventually get to. So we see the ninth horn. Let's talk about Mussolini just for a minute. Mussolini, again, reading from the same history. Mussolini saw that he could use the church to legitimize his power. Often when you look at the relationship between the papacy and Europe, it was, who's the stronger of the two? Okay, well, I'll say that I'm bowing to him so that I can get his power. And sometimes it was one and sometimes it was the other. Mussolini saw that he could use the church to legitimize his power, so he set about to woo the clergy. He had his wife and children baptized. Now, he didn't, but he had his wife and children baptized. He gave money for the restoration of the churches. And after two generations of secularism, there was once again crucifixes in Italy's courts and in Italy's classrooms. Warily, the Pope became persuaded that with Mussolini's help, Italy might become one more confessional state and one more resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. So, again, under Mussolini, and then a little later on, through the auspices of what Mussolini and Hitler were doing, they pulled this back together yet once again for one more reign at the Holy Roman Empire. But now, we've got to figure out who this tenth one is. So let's go back and let's think about, if we look at the picture again, we know that right at the very end, there are going to be ten toes, part of iron and part of clay. We know as we go through this that we've gone through nine of the ten, but there has to be this tenth one. There has to be this final one that we haven't seen yet. Let's go through now and let's try and understand who that is. Let's go to Revelation chapter 17 now, and let's read about who is going to reign over this final resurrection. Revelation chapter 17. We'll go back a little bit in history just to be able to bring this up to the very end. Revelation chapter 17, I've got a picture of it here. It's a little hard to see because it's all very red. But you can see the same beast. It looks very similar to the beast that you saw over here, but it has a woman riding atop of it. Let's read. Chapter 17, verse 1. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying, "Come and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters." Remember, this beast rose up out of the waters, this beast with seven heads and ten horns, "with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication." So whoever this woman is, kings of the earth would have bowed down to her. Verse 3, "So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit on top of a scarlet beast, and it was full of names of blasphemy, and it had seven heads and ten horns." You're going to see in just a moment these are different than the seven heads and ten horns of Revelation chapter 13. It will identify them here in just a bit. Verse 4, "The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication." Notice what the name of this was. On her forehead a name was written, "Mystery, Babylon the Great." Who was Babylon? It was the first of the world-ruling empires. So an essence or an element of the Babylonian Empire was still a part of this last world-ruling empire. What we see at the very end is going to inculcate all the way back to Babylon. "Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman, again, drunk with the blood of the saints." We've seen this all the way through. There would be a persecution all along of the true saints of God. "With the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement." I mean, it would have been something to see. I mean, and from John's perspective, he probably was in awe at this terrifying beast. And then to realize there's a woman who is... I mean, imagine sitting on this terrifying beast and you've got a woman who's grabbed it by two of the horns and is leading this. So this must be a really powerful woman to be able to control something as horrendous as this beast. So what we see again, as we go through this, we're going to find out that there were five beasts that were... Again, we'll put this back up. We see Justinian, Charlemagne, Otto the Great, Charles the Great, Napoleon. One is, and one is yet to come. So this woman that rides on this beast rides on the seven heads, and then the last head will have ten horns. These ten horns identify with the ten toes. Verse 7. "The angel said to me, 'Why are you marveling?'" I almost think that the angel was a little bit irritated at John. This is not a good person. Why are you excited about this? Don't be excited. You should be horrified by this. "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that she carries, which has seven heads and ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not, but will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition." It existed for a while and then it seemed to stop. In 1814, it looked like it was over again. That's happened a couple of times. Yet it just keeps resurrecting. It keeps ascending out of the bottomless pit. And it will go, this time, all the way to perdition, all the way until it's finally done. "And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains," mountains symbolic of nations, "on which the woman sits. And those seven heads were also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and one is yet to come. And he will continue a little time. And the beast that was not and is not is himself of the eighth, one of the seventh, and goes into perdition." Now let's look at the very end, verse 12. "The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have not received a kingdom as yet, but they will receive authority for 1 hour with the beast." So at the very end, there's going to be ten kings that will come together that you're going to see will marry back to what Daniel saw, where these iron mixed with clay. And they will continue for a very short time. I have something that I will hand out afterwards if you are interested in this. Some of you have probably seen this from days gone by. But if you don't have a copy of it or haven't seen it, The church put this out a long time ago. So this is very similar. You can see it up there. It's got Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 8, Revelation 13, Revelation 17. Just what I went through in picture. This has all of the verses. It has who it was. It has what year it was. So that you can look at this and you can identify when Daniel saw it in Daniel 2, when Daniel saw it in Daniel 7, in Daniel 8, Revelation 13, Revelation 17, who corresponded to who. And out at the very end, it's got the fulfillment of it. So if you can read this, I know it's a little tough. You can see that it was the Chaldean or the Babylonian Empire, was the prophetic head, was the lion, or was the head of gold. And you can see that all the way down to the final 10 toes, which represent the 10 toes here, or the 10th horn, all the way through. This is what we're going to be studying about right now. Who is going to be this final one? We've seen 6 of the 7. Who is this final one going to be, and when is it going to appear? So if you are interested in this, I have this chart up here. Again, I would say, even though I feel pretty comfortable with this, we may find out somewhere down the line that a date or two would slip, or there may be something else that we haven't seen that will become clearer later. But this will at least give you a very good idea of what it is that we are looking at or looking for. So you can come up and see this chart in a little while. But now let's look at this again. Revelation chapter 17 and verse 12. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom yet, but they will receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. Whatever is going to happen right at the very end, something is going to cause 10 kings to come together. What is going to cause that? These are of one mind, and they will give their power and they will give their authority to the beast. But they will also make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for He is Lord of lords and King of kings. So whoever this final 10, this last resurrection, is going to represent, instead of one king or one emperor or one Caesar, there are going to be 10 kings or 10 toes. But they're going to be of one purpose, but like Daniel's image, they're not going to mix very well together. But something is going to cause them to come together. What will that be? Verse 16, the 10 horns which you saw on the beast, they will eventually come to hate the harlot, even though they used the harlot to come together. They will eventually hate the harlot, make her desolate, naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God has put in their hearts to fulfill His purpose, to be of one mind and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So as we look at this, we recognize that something will cause 10 kings to unite under the banner of the Holy Roman Empire. Something will happen that will bring them together. They will be, if you remember what Daniel 11 verse 40 says, a king of the south is going to push against the north. Something from the south is going to cause these 10 nations to have to get together to defend themselves. Even if you look and you can see this, conglomeration of people. I used this a couple of months ago when I did the King of the South. You remember when the Charlie Hebdo event happened in France, and all of a sudden, all of these European leaders got together and marched down the street. This, to me, is representative of something that's going to happen in the future. Now, it's not the Charlie Hebdo thing, but whenever it happens, it's going to be something like this. The South is going to start pushing against the North. No, I'm not talking about the Civil War. The people from Ishmael and Esau are going to be coalescing together, and they're going to come and they're going to start pushing against the north. As happened in this case, the United States didn't come in and help. So guess what? When the United States didn't come in, Europe got together. And they went down arm in arm. People that don't like each other, these are not countries that like each other. They're all part of the European Union, which we'll talk about in a minute. But they will come together for a short time. What will trigger this? The king of the south will push against the king of the north. And it will bring this final union of 10 nations together. The union will be as strong as iron. And they are very strong. You talk about the elements of Germany and Austria and Italy and France and Spain. They are very, very strong people. But they won't mix well together. They have very different ideals. But they will come together under the auspices of the papacy to be this last resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. In the end, it says they will defeat most of the powers of the Middle East. They will fight against the armies. They will eventually fight against the papacy and destroy it. And then they will turn at the very end and fight against the returning Jesus Christ. It's actually going to be fighting against you. Do you realize that? When you're resurrected and you come back with Jesus Christ to fight the armies that are fighting against God, it will be this last resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. These 10 kings will be fighting against us. So who will be this final 10 nations? I want to talk about this for a moment. I'm not talking about from a perspective of, let me name names, let me tell you who the 10 kings are. I obviously don't know that yet. Nobody does. I also am going to show you some pictures, and I don't want the pictures to start conspiracy theory, because I'm not into that. I am not. I'm the last person on the planet that gets into conspiracy theory. But there's some hints that we can look at as we look at some of these pictures to come. When the European Union first got together, the European Union consists of the same nations, the Napoleonic nations, or the Otto the Greats, or the Habsburg dynasties, or the Germans, the Austrians, they all got together. They needed a banner in which to unite themselves. When it first started together, it was called the European Economic Community. You remember that? They started kind of pooling that. Let's try and get a common currency going. Took decades to get that done. They have the euro now. But they needed a banner under which to try and unite that. There was a poster that came out early on in the days of the European Union when they were trying to pull that together. Anybody ever remember seeing this poster? This was Europe, many tongues, one voice. What's the idea behind that? You've got German, you've got French, you've got Austrian, you've got Polish, you've got all of these different languages. We need to somehow unite those languages into a single Europe. So what symbol did they use for it? Everybody should be able to tell me what that is. That is the Tower of Babel. What happened at the Tower of Babel? The languages were divided, which divided Europe and Asia and the Middle East into different countries. The symbol that was used by Europe in the late 1800s and early 1900s, we've got to try and come up with a symbol to bring us back together. And so in the 1930s and 40s, somebody drew this up and said, this is how we can show that we want to unite it. We want to bring back, we want to finish the Tower of Babel. Now, who was the first world-ruling empire? Babylon. So it makes sense that the final 10 powers that will come together will want the background of Babylon, of Medo-Persia, of Greece, and of the Roman Empire, because that's where they get their strength. The strength comes in their history. So from many different nations, we want to reunite them, and they used this symbol of the Tower of Babel, something that God separated to try and pull it back together, which would eventually fight against God when he returned. Now, this next picture, and again, this is one where I want to make sure that we don't get into conspiracy theories. I'm not showing it from that perspective. I just want to show this because I think it's interesting. The picture on the left, and let me make sure I get it right. This is a picture of the Tower of Babel painted by Bruegel from Vienna. This is a picture that was painted by a European painter. I don't have the year, but I want to say it was in the 1700s or 1800s. When it was decided that they needed to try and come up with an EU Parliament building, the European Union Parliament building, the design on the right is what they ended up with. It was intended to be an unfinished building. The Tower of Babel was left unfinished. The reason why the architect made the building unfinished was, and if you ask the architect won't say, oh, I made it to look like the Tower of Babel. The architect will say, because when we first made this building, we didn't know who would comprise the final Europe. It would be built as it would come. So he built the building to look unfinished, meaning this will always be changing. There will be more nations that will be added to it, and as we add more nations, we'll become greater and greater and greater. But if you look at the comparison between the two buildings, you can see that, in essence, it looks similar to I never can pronounce his name unless I look at it. Bruegel's image. Now, I want to read this too. It says, the voluntary, unfinished aspect of the 60-meter-high tower carries heavy symbolism. It is alleged to have been oriented eastward toward Eastern Europe, of which by the time of the completion of the building, No country had yet joined the European Union. This building was built before the EU actually came together. It was an EC, but not an EU yet. This was built in advance of that. However, the open side of the tower actually faces west. Urban legends, started by Glenn Beck — I'm not a Glenn Beck fanatic, I'm reading, okay? So again, this isn't conspiracy theory. Urban legends and internet memes have long alleged that the design conspicuously mirrors the Tower of Babel as painted by Bruegel. And although unfounded, the rumor entered mainstream media through Glenn Beck. My point is, the final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire under the power of the papacy will come from the nations that, from which Babylon, Media Persia, Greece, and the Roman Empire came from. There, something is going to happen at the very end that will cause 10 of these nations from the northern part to fight against some ruler that is going to come from the south. Again, if you remember what Daniel 11:40 says, something's going to happen in the south that's going to push against the north, and 10 kings are going to say, I've had enough. It's time for us to take over. We need help. The good offices of the Pope will help, and they will put it together. If you look at who is in, these are the member nations of the EU right now, and what year they entered. So there they all are. There's, and I didn't count them, there's 26, 27 nations, something like that. We know from looking at these, and I say we know, for those people that that have the same belief system that I do, that that when the 10 nations of Israel went into captivity and then went out from there and became many of the nations of Europe, the United Kingdom, as an example, we don't believe would be a part of this end time conglomeration of 10 nations, because that represents Europe, as does many of the others in here. You can look through a lot of these. Finland, a part of France, a part of Denmark, a lot of these, the Netherlands, would be a part of what we would consider to be a part of the lost 10 tribes today, and would not comprise this. But something will happen at the end to where there will be 10 nations come out of Europe that will come together under the offices of the Pope and will take over. Revelation 17, 12 and 13, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings. They have not received a kingdom yet. They haven't come together yet. But they will receive authority for 1 hour. It'll be a very short period of time, right at the very end. Hadn't happened yet. Doesn't happen. Doesn't have to happen yet. Not going to happen until right at the very end. These will be of one mind, and they will give their power and their authority to this resurrection of this final beast power. All right, so that is as much as we can come up with right now. The current thought, again, in the church is that of these nations of the EU, 10 of them will form the final Holy Roman Empire. They will claim the title of the Holy Roman Empire. So if you want to know what to look for, there's three things. They're very simple. We've talked about them the whole way through these last three sermons. Who will the final resurrection be? Sorry, there goes my throat. Three things to look for. There has to be a push from the south. Before these 10 nations can unite, they have to be pushed at from the south. That has to happen first. You are not going to see 10 nations get together for no reason. The first thing that has to happen is there has to be a push at Europe from the south. Number one. Number two, 10 nations have to realize that in order to deal with this threat from the south, they have got to put aside their national boundaries and come together for a period of time to fight, to unify against a single foe. And three, all 10 of these kings have to bow to the unification or to the unifying powers of the papacy, because we know that the woman has to ride the final 10 horns of the beast. So the push has to come from the south. The 10 nations have to agree to unite, and then they have to come together under the power of the papacy. They will be again called the Holy Roman Empire. You will hear them use that term. So that's what we're waiting for. Now, what I want to do to end this, I just have a few more slides. I want to talk about what the Bible says will happen to this final world ruling empire, these final 10 kings. Remember back to Daniel. Let's go to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel 11 and verse 40.
Am I doing on time?
Oh, boy. Not good. Okay.
Verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south will attack him. The king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. And he will enter those countries and overwhelm them and pass through. The king of the north is going to come down and is going to kick tail. And anybody that's in his way, he's going to take over. He will enter the glorious land, so we know that he will take over in Jerusalem and in Israel. And many countries will be overthrown. But these will escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. That is the modern nation of Jordan. Jordan will escape the king of the north's push against the king of the south. For whatever reason, Jordan will be not in that group of countries. Maybe we'll have some type of alliance with them, we don't know. He will stretch out his hand against the countries, against the land of Egypt, will not escape. And he will have power over the Egyptians, the Libyans, the Ethiopians. He's going to go all the way down from Europe. He's going to go all the way down through the Holy Land, all the way down into Africa, and he's going to take over. Verse 45, he will plant his tents of his palace between the seas of the glorious holy mountain, yet he will come to an end, and no one will help him. You remember, as we look back at what it was said in Daniel chapter 2, verse 34 and 35, you see that on the screen. At the very end, it says, for these 10 toes, a stone was cut without hands, which struck the image on the feet of iron and clay, and it broke them in pieces. The iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold, everything that had to do with all this world-ruling empires, all four of them, will be crushed together. They will become like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind will carry them away so that there will be no trace of them left. I say again, I'm going to give a sermon later on about politics. God is not coming back to fix this world's politics. He's coming back to replace them. When he returns, he will destroy the world ruling empires. Nothing will be left. They will be dirt that will be blown by the wind as chaff. And the stone that struck the image will become a great mountain and will fill the whole earth. So we know again from this period of time that this final kingdom will come to an end. Zechariah chapter 12. I'm rushing now. Let me just slow down a little bit and finish this. I may be 5 minutes late, but let me do this justice since I'm this close. Zechariah chapter 12, verse 2 and 3. We know that when these 10 nations come, it says they will come through the glorious land and they will plant their flag in the glorious land. We know that they're going to take over Jerusalem. Notice what it says here, verse 2. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all of the surrounding peoples when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. The king of the south is going to push up against them, and the king of the south is evidently going to try and take over Jerusalem. They're going to be drunk with the giddiness of finally taking back over the Temple Mount area completely and wiping the Jews out. Who knows what it's going to be. King of the north, drunk with the giddiness of taking over and protecting Israel and Judah, will go down against it. We know that Jerusalem will be a cup of drunkenness. Verse 3, and it will happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all people, and all who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all nations of the earth will be gathered against it. The final battle of Armageddon will happen in that very area. The nations of the north and the nations of the south that are fighting, the nations of the south will be defeated. But if you read in the prophecies about Armageddon, they will see the returning Christ and then they will turn their attention and try and fight against Christ when he returns. Jerusalem will be a heavy, heavy stone. Revelation chapter 18, verse 1 through 3. Again, I have it up on the screen here. After these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison of every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. Think about Babylon. Think about Media Persia. Think about Greece. Think about the Roman Empire. These are things that God is going to come and replace. They become a habitation for all of the evil that represents this world. God will come back and will take it out. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. But we know that not only will they be replaced, but here is the warning for you and me today. And I want to end with this slide. I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people." We are not to be a part of the king of the south. We are not to be a part of the king of the north. We are not to be a part of this. "Come out of her, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Render to her just as she has rendered to you. Repay her double according to her works. In the cup which she has mixed, mix double for her. In the measure that she has glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow. For she says in her heart, 'I sit as queen and am no widow, and will not see sorrow.' Therefore her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire. For strong is the Lord God who judges her." My brethren, all of what you see coming, the king of the north, the king of the south, the final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, will come to an end. The return of Jesus Christ will bring it to a close, and his kingdom will be set up. Whoever these final kings will be, again, you will see them come together because of a push from the south. You will see them come together with the office of the papacy to make sure that they can defeat this. But ultimately, even that great power, and it will be great and terrible, will come to an end. So as we see these events happening, as we see these things coming, hopefully we can be pulling to mind, putting back into our mind the things that are happening through the king of the north, the king of the south, and that the church, as it were, will be ready for this, will recognize it for what it is. I believe, brethren, as you look through many of the prophecies of the Bible, it talks about even an innumerable multitude that comes out of great tribulation, that washes their robe in the sins of this world, as it were, but washes them clean through the death of Jesus Christ. I think a lot of people, and I'm going to talk about this on the day of Pentecost, as we talk about the building of the church, the impact of the church will not be felt until the time of the end. And people will remember. Anytime something happens, I remember when 9/11 happened, and I don't know if it happened to you or not, I had people come out of the woodwork from 20, 30 years ago and say, "Is this it?" There are people that know, and the work of the church is there. You may not see it, but just like that Rubik's Cube, I used that as an example one time. A Rubik's Cube that's just a few clicks away from being done looks completely jumbled up. Yet, 1, 2, 3, and it's there. When God puts this together and decides now, it will happen very quickly. You need to be ready for it. You need to be prepared. It may not be a very happy time for the church. It talks about persecution. But it will be something that we can live through. And it will be something that if we do live through, we will return with Jesus Christ to help defeat this final king of the north. So, brethren, I hope this was useful and helpful to you. And will help us out in prophecies. There still are many more prophecies to go that I would like to go through. 70 weeks prophecy and some other things that we'll be talking about as we go. Probably generate some interest or some discussion afterwards. Again, hopefully you found this useful and helpful. I have these handouts. If you want to come and get one, they'll just be up here on the stage. If you are interested in seeing them, they will be here for you.